A couple weeks ago in staff meeting, Pastor Andrew brought a quote. It was good, and I wanted to share it with you. Apparently, some time ago, now we're talking like not in the last sort of 10 years, but probably 100 or so years ago, a preacher in London by the name of Joseph Carroll preached through the book of Job. Now, I'm not familiar with him, but apparently he took 23 years, 424 sermons, get through the book. And at the end of it, wrote this: "I have not yet attained a clear understanding of some of these passages," which I find wonderfully comforting. For and I'll explain why. Because if as we're working through this, there are points where we're still wrestling, the comforting fact is we're in good company. And it's also comforting because I conclude this. Here's what I conclude from that. That probably what that means is that there is no end to the depth of the Word of God. Like if you could spend 424 sermons on the book of Job and still not get to the end of it, that means you could probably spend a lifetime and not get to the end of it. And I love that. Because if God's Word was a book that you could take a two-week course on and go, I've got it, there's nothing left. I now understand it all. There's no more joy of discovery. There's no more moments where God's going to meet me in His Word and open my eyes to something new. That would be a heartbreaking thing. But I'm incredibly encouraged. Now, in case you're just kind of new or visiting here this morning, we are not going to take 23 years on Job. But, you know, like 6 months will probably feel like enough by the time we're done. But we are in chapter 3. That's where we're going to get to work this morning. And hopefully, as we get through, God's going to do some good things. I'm going to read it, the whole chapter, and then we'll start walking through what it means and how we're going to live this out. After this, which I'm going to stop, but I'm not going to do this the whole way through, in case you're wondering. I just want to make sure we know what the this is, so that we've kind of got the picture. The this would at least be chapter 1 and 2, probably with a focus on 2, 11 to 13. So if it's been a bit since you've been in Job, the plot line to this point becomes something like this. God proposes a contest of sorts. I'm not sure I love that word, but I will use it. Just I can't think of a better one at the moment. A contest of sort. Oh. Hi, by the way. All the Kairos family. Evangelina. Anyway. I'm glad we don't have bigger windows. I'd be endlessly distracted. Where were we? Job, the contest. Here we go. There's where we were. So God is the one who actually proposes this, which in and of itself is kind of an interesting thing you have to wrestle through. God proposes a contest of sorts with Satan, and here's the contest. Satan, have you ever considered Job? He's righteous, he's an upright man, he fears the Lord in the sense of what it really truly means biblically to fear the Lord. And it's helpful at this point, just make sure we're all on the same page. What does it mean to fear the Lord? It's not to be scared of God. When you put the two words together, that's how it seems, right? You put fear in God, it's like, it must mean that we're afraid or terrified of Him. That's as helpful as trying to fit, I use the example, the word butterfly together, right? You take the word butterfly, and you pull the words apart, you got butter and fly. It doesn't help you understand what a butterfly is, right? So when you do put the words together properly, scripturally, the fear of the Lord means something along the lines of a trust, a devotion to the Lord that leaves you in awe of who He is. It would be kind of the words that I would say get at the heart of what it truly means to fear the Lord. So we meet Job, a man who has an awe and a devotion and a trust in the Lord. And God says to Satan, have you ever considered Him? And here it becomes the contest of sorts. Will Job, if he has everything stripped away from him in life, all of his prosperity, his family, everything he has, will he still trust God? Or if you took away everything that God's given, will he simply give up? Give up on God? Not live for God's glory? That becomes the wager. So chapter 1, everything, sort of his possessions, his flocks, all his wealth, gone. Job, we meet at the end of chapter 1, a bankrupt man, his kids, all 10 of them have died. We meet him and we find out he will still say, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I will return, blessed be the name of the Lord. Job does not curse. And that's the center of what this contest is all about. Satan is convinced, God, if you did that, if you let me strike him, he will curse you to your face. And God says, I don't think he will. Now, God actually doesn't say that, but we know because of what's going on, that's God's certainty. Job will not do this. So, round two, Satan comes essentially saying, you know what? The reason he hasn't done it yet is because you haven't let me strike him physically, but if you strike a man where it hurts most, let me torment his body, let me inflict severe pain, he will curse you to your face. God allows that to happen. Chapter 2, Job's health is stripped from him. We meet him at the end of chapter 2. We find him on a heap of ashes, having lost everything. His wife has already come and said, basically, Job, why don't you just curse God and die? He is a lonely, lonely man with nothing. His friends arrive right near the end of chapter 3. They do a very puzzling thing. They sit there for 7 days. Must have been an interesting week. I wonder what went through their minds, what went through Job's mind. We're going to see a little bit through the next few chapters, some of what they will have to say that we'll wrestle through. But for a week, they sit there in silence, seeing that his suffering was very great. That is the this. Okay, so now we're all on the same page. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. That's a very important little statement, right? Because what's been the contest? He will curse God. He won't. He will get him oh so close in chapter 3. I'm going to suggest to you, he doesn't ever step over the line. But instead, he turns the attention onto his own life. And he said, here we go. Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived, let that day be darkness. May God above never seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none. Nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out of the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me? Why did the breasts, or why the breast that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept and been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuild ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. There they hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there. The slave is free from his master. Why is light given to him who's in misery, and life to the bitter in soul? Who long for death, but it comes not. Who dig for it more than hidden treasure. Who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave. Why is light given to man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread. My groanings are poured out like water. For the thing I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. Our challenge today is to figure out what to do with Job chapter 3. When I read through chapter 1 and 2, I honestly get to the point where in my mind's eye, I feel like I understand the lay of the land. We've got God, we've got Satan, we've got a massive contest, and we have a man named Job who is our hero. That's how I want to read the story, that Job will be the hero of the story. But heroes don't say things like Job chapter 3. That's not what heroes say. Heroes say things like, with great power comes great responsibility for you Spider-Man fans. For those of us a little bit older, I'm here to fight for truth, justice, and the American way, Superman fans. That's what heroes say. They don't say, curse the day I was born. Like, I wish if I had been born, then I wish I was at least a stillborn child. Okay, if I had been born and I wasn't stillborn, then I wish I died after my dad bounced me on his knee. If I hadn't died then, why can't I just die now? Does not sound like the slogan of a hero. And so we have some wrestling to do here this morning to figure out what to do with Job chapter 3. Now, before we kind of wrestle through it, I think it's important that we actually understand what he's saying. All right? So let's take that step first. Let's just kind of backtrack through this chapter and make sure we kind of understand what he's suggesting and how it fits together. I think the chapter is basically, it's going to be three pieces. From verse 3 to 10 is a curse, where Job is going to curse himself. He won't curse the Lord. He curses himself. For those of you who love this stuff, you could go and read, the formula that ancient curses take. And actually, verse 3 to 10 basically takes that formula. Then from verse 11 to 19, we have a lament, which is Job just in sorrow, kind of pouring out his heart. And then from verse 20 to 26, we have a question. There's actually a couple questions. And let's actually add one more word, because they're not just questions, they're just gut-wrenching, agonizing questions. These are the ones that we hesitate to even say out loud. That's the chapter, okay? So let's just kind of look at those parts, and see what he says. So verse 3 to 10, he's going to curse the day he was born. Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, a man is conceived, let that day be darkness. Now what Job's doing is he's going to go all the way back to Genesis 1 and pull references from Genesis 1, so he's essentially going to ask for the day of his birth to be uncreated. And we won't look at all of how that functions, but that's when you're reading this light and dark and deep darkness, and that's essentially what it boils down to. He knows there is a God who's created all things. He has confidence in that God. He's a man who fears that God. But now he says, you know what? I wish that day on the calendar just didn't exist. So for me, the equivalent would be me saying, I was born October 23rd, I wish that every time we got to the 22nd of October, it just jumped to the 24th. That's Job's wish. So actually, he uses wish verbs. Again, this is for those of us who like this kind of Bible geek stuff. Let and may. There are two particular verbs that are known sort of like a wish verb. So this is what he's wanting. He's saying, this is what I want to have happen. Let the day perish. Let that day be darkness. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell on it. Let blackness of the day terrify it. Let thick darkness seize it. You hear what he's doing? This is what I want to have happen. I want the day gone. What do you do with a guy who's held up in chapter 1 and 2 as the most righteous man on earth, who by chapter 3 is saying, God, I just want you to undo it. I want you to undo my very existence. I want to be as one who never was. There's a progression, right? You can kind of see it again as you walk through this chapter. He wishes first he hadn't been conceived. So some of the language for us in English is a little bit hard. It says it in verse 3, but it shows up a couple other times. Basically, he looks back to the night of his conception and says, I wish that night had never happened. His language, he picks it up in verse 7. Behold, let that night be barren. That night was fruitful. A child was conceived. He says, I wish it had been a barren night. Nothing had ever been conceived out of that night. Then he moves on to his second wish, which is that he had just died in the womb, been stillborn, that there had been no life. Now this is gut-wrenching stuff. I see the looks. It was kind of interesting in the first service, you know, because by the time we got to near the end of kind of this walkthrough, we're sort of like, wow, this is uncomfortable. To hear a man this raw. Along the way, let me just talk with a couple things that we might not see clearly. Verse 8, let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. What on earth does that mean? I mean, a lot of it we understand. That one's a little bit odd. He's basically saying, I am a beginner at cursing, but I think there's others out there who are experts. I would like the experts to join me in cursing the day in case I get it wrong. That's actually what it means. So in order to say that, he talks about a leviathan, which is a mythical seven-headed creature. This is not saying Job believes in myth. This is all This is poetry. He's expressing raw, strong emotion. So here's what it's all about. Leviathan in ancient Near East mythology is a seven-headed creature who is summoned out of the ocean by like the professional cursors. And when the Leviathan comes out of the ocean, Leviathan swallows the sun. So basically what they thought was anytime there was an eclipse of the sun, someone had summoned the Leviathan and it had swallowed the sun. I don't know how it unswallowed, because I mean, I've seen some eclipses. It does come back. Anyway, I don't know how that ends, but you see what Job's doing there in verse 8. He's saying, I know out there there's this belief that there's people who could curse things, they could call up the Leviathan. I wish they were here right now to call up the Leviathan and swallow that day. Just make it like it never existed. I wish, he says, that day, that first star, verse 9, that first star of dawn, I wish it had just stayed black. So that day had never happened. Starting to get the feel, right, of where Job's at. Or the eyelids of the morning, right? That when he's sort of depicting the day almost in a human form. That, you know, the eyelid opens, the eyelid of the day. He said, I just wish it had just stayed shut. I wish the doors of my mother's womb. And this is the reason. Everything he said up to now, this is the curse. Now he's going to give us the reason. Job, why are you saying what you're saying? Because, or for, it didn't shut the doors of my mother's womb. Why do I want that day gone? Because I was born. I mean, just stop and think for a second of how odd this is. Because we often get to celebrate, you know, couples who, they conceive, and we get, you know, the word. It's like, can we announce it yet? And it's like, okay, now you can. And then we use language like this. They're expecting. Right? It's this hope-filled, joyful thing. And Job's taken the whole thing and just turned it completely upside down. And said, you want to know the worst thing that has ever happened to me? That I was born. That's his curse, okay? Verse 11 to 19 is his lament. He actually asks a couple questions in this. Verse 11 and then verse 16. Why did I not die at birth or come out of the womb and expire? And then verse 16. Why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? Why couldn't I be one of them? Is what Job's saying. Like, they've got off easy. That's his point. And between those two questions, he talks about death. He talks about great men who have built massive things and been men of significance. The word he uses for kings and counselors is a phrase used throughout the Old Testament, basically to speak of kind of the influential, the rich. He said, they come, they build great things, and then they die, and the stuff they built is in ruins, and all that's left is one house, it's a mausoleum they built. He said, oh, they've got it good. I wish I could be like one of them. Or he says, there's these other people. They're prisoners. They were slaves, and they cried out with groaning, and now they've died, and they don't have to listen to the voice of their taskmaster anymore. Oh, they have it good. I just wish I could be like one of them. This is his lament. His lament is that he's alive. Verse 20 to the end, he asks a series of questions. He actually asks questions all through this chapter that his friends will attempt to answer throughout the rest of the book. That's going to be where we go over the next number of weeks from chapter 4 on. They have heard his questions. I'm going to contend they just haven't heard his heart. You know the difference? They will try to technically answer the questions he's asking. But you know from the way they're answering, it's like they never heard the desperation of the cry of this man's heart. And then at the end, God will ask his own questions, which I think fits well if we understand this is where Job starts. This is his speech, full of questions. God gets to the end and says, Job, I've got some questions for you. We'll be there somewhere in July, probably. Okay, so what are the questions? Verse 20, why is light given to him who's in misery? And life to the bitter in soul. Why would God do that? Why would God even let someone who is as miserable as me, Job is saying. By the way, he switched here from singular to plural. So this, and we'll talk about that a bit later. Why would he give life to the bitter in soul? Bitter in soul, that phrase I think is used three times in the Old Testament, three more times. One, when David loses his kingdom to his son Absalom. They're on the way out of Jerusalem and they look back at the city and they're bitter. It's gone. It's all gone. Not just is his kingdom gone, it's his family is destroyed. The other time, interesting enough, Naomi. Start of the book. She cannot have a child and is there weeping, bitter. It's the kind of suffering we're talking about. Job there saying, I don't understand why God even gives life with that kind of hardship. Verse 21, who long for death, but it doesn't come. Who dig for it more than hidden treasures. There's an interesting expression, a picture, right? You know the story of treasure hunters? They give their whole lives. They believe if we could just dig down here, somewhere there's treasure. And some of them lose everything, convinced of the treasure that's to be found. You can't stop them. Job says, that's me. I want to find the grave. With the same fury and passion that a treasure hunter uses to find treasure. And they rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find it. Job says, oh, when that day comes. Starting to see why this is a little bit interesting territory. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? The hidden, that's the same word that the Proverbs often uses in terms of way. So it's like your path in life, your meaning in life, your purpose in life. Job's saying, you know what, I thought I knew. I thought I knew why I was here. The flocks, the sheep, the family, it made sense. And now it's all gone. Now there is no purpose. There is no plan. There is no meaning. So why would God give me life? And then he's hedged me in. This is different than the hedging in chapter 1. In chapter 1, we meet almost the identical phrase. God had hedged him in terms of protecting him. So nothing can hurt him. He was safe and secure. And Satan said, God, if you remove that, well, we're going to see what he's really made of. Now Job's saying, God's hedged me in. It's like, but now it's like, I am trapped. This isn't a protective wall now. This is like, I'm trapped. I can't get out and no one can get in. I'm on my own, stuck. Sighing comes instead of bread. Groaning is poured out like water. Don't picture a guy because the words are not sort of someone off there on the side suffering quietly. That kind of thing. Actually, it's the same word for a lion roaring. This is that uncontrolled wailing that when you hear it, you just go, oh, don't even know what to do in response to that. For the thing that I fear has come upon me, and what I dread befell me. And then his last verse, four rapid, almost like bullet shots, just choo, choo, choo. I'm not at ease, I'm not quiet, I have no rest, trouble comes. Okay, there we go. That feels great. And it's nice that we did it on a nice spring Sunday like this. We took down the Christmas tree just for this occasion. All right, let's see what we're supposed to do with this. I'm going to get to a list of five things. That's where we're on our way to, that I think are important just in light of this, of how we work through some of this stuff. But before we get to the list, I want to raise a couple questions. I'm not sure I will totally answer them this morning. We're going to come back to them because they're going to reappear for us throughout Job. But the first question is this. Job clearly seems what I would call depressed. We maybe could wrestle back and forth on what the right term is. Despondent, despair. I'm just going to use depressed. Here's the question. Did he sin? Is Job chapter 3 sin? Now, I'm going to give you my answer, where I'm at, and I'm going to encourage you to wrestle with that question. To me, that seems like a very, very important question, not just for Job 3, but for the rest of the book. My answer is no. My answer is no. It seems like he's getting close to that, but Job 3, in and of itself, is not that. Any more than anger is necessarily sin. It is strong, strong emotion. But we're told in the New Testament, in your anger, in the middle of that kind of strong emotion, don't sin. Which seems to raise a couple interesting things. Number one is it's not by its very essence sin, but it exposes us to some, I was going to say opportunity. That sounds like a weird word. It's the only one I'm coming up with. Sometimes when you're here, it's like, oh, why am I? It's not the right word. You'll know the right word. We'll go with it. Opportunity, a unique opportunity to sin, although that sounds like it's a positive thing. Find the word that means the negative version of that, then you'll have the one I'm looking for. Right? So Job's in a dangerous spot here because he's wrestling with some big stuff. He is, I think, starting to see his hope and trust in God slip through his fingers. But I would contend that he is at a spot that I would call temptation. It's a temptation to sin, but it isn't the sin itself. And usually when we know, we're so glad you didn't step over that line. Way to go. You hoped in God. Now, in Job's case, it's going to take a while. And maybe that's what's hard for us to wrestle with. We're not even sure how long. In fact, the timeline of the book of Job is a little bit fuzzy. The only verse that really helps us out is Job chapter 7, I think it's verse 3, where Job talks in terms of months. This is a month's journey for Job. Not days, not weeks, months. And over the course of this time, he wrestles with some dangerous things, some tempting things, but I don't think necessarily sinful things. In fact, I wanted to actually tell you a story, and I started telling it in the early service, and then I ran out of time badly. So I'll give you even more compressed version, and I will commend to you to go and read the story of William Cooper, Cowper, depending, I think it's pronounced Cooper, but it's, for us Canadians, it looks like Cowper, C-O-W-P-E-R. Born in 1731, died in the year 1800. He wrote many of the great hymns, wrote 68 hymns, many of them written in conjunction with John Newton, who was one of his close friends. John Newton was known as the happy preacher. I love that. It was said of John Newton that people respected some preachers, they loved John Newton. But William Cooper couldn't have been more different. By the time he was six, he had lost five of his siblings, and then his mom died. He wrote a poem about it when he was 53, looking back at that. And when you read the poem all those years later, you realize, the guy still, he's never recovered. At six, he was sent away to a boarding school because his dad just couldn't deal with life. He was badly mistreated throughout his years at boarding school. He finally, as a teenager, found the love of his life, a young gal named Theodora. Now, remember, we're 1700s, so what I'm about to tell you next sounds maybe weird to our ears. It was his cousin. They were allowed to date, they were engaged, and for 7 years, he thought he had found the love of his life until her father did not give permission for them to marry. Neither he nor her would ever marry. He would write poems about her, always under the name Delilah. I don't do with that as you want. At age 31, after having come right up to the point of writing his exams to become a lawyer, his dad was a very prominent, very wealthy man, pushed him towards becoming a lawyer. The week before, the weight of it was just about to crush him. So he decided the only option was to end his life. He went down to the wharf. The water was low. Couldn't do it. Some of the stories, it's almost funny if it wasn't so tragic. He came home, he tried to stab himself to death, the knife broke. He tried to hang himself four times. He almost succeeded the last time. He actually was unconscious when the rope broke and his landlady found him. I mean, he was done. He tried to poison himself. I mean, he was done. At age 31, was put into a mental hospital, interestingly enough, run by a Christian, who there shared with him the truth of Jesus Christ. He gave his life to the Lord. And it's right at that point where you go, oh, I love these stories. Happily ever after. Like, did he get back together with her? Like, this must be when he started writing the hymns, right? I said, yes, yes. And for the next 38 years, struggled with the depression that was so dark, it just threatened to just swallow him alive. He didn't stop wrestling with depression, with suicide. Never ended. In fact, the last words he ever wrote before he died was, "I feel unutterable despair." And yet, to this day, we sing some of the most profound declarations of the truth of who Jesus is that came off his pen. And when I watch a life like that and read men like Charles Spurgeon and Calvin, who will write of similar sort of struggle, struggle with a darkness and a depression, I conclude that it is not necessarily a sin. Now, I think a prolonged, like if you just say, "I give in, I give up," that is just it. I think now we're at a point where maybe my opinion would shift a little bit. But I think we need to be really, really careful with what we do with this whole area of depression. Because all through the pages of Scripture it shows up. You just go read David. You go read the life of Elijah. You meet Paul on a ship in Acts 27 saying, "We gave up all hope." That's an interesting phrase. What does that look like? We gave up all hope. You see, some of you just need to be encouraged to know that you can wrestle through this. We're going to get back to that. That's, I think, the first big question. I think we'll come back to it throughout the book, because it's not like Job 3 shows up and then Job 4, everything's good, and on he goes. It's a reoccurring struggle in Job's life. The second big question that I think we need to wrestle with here, and we will continue to wrestle with, is this a right way to speak to God? Let's presume he is speaking to God, and that's maybe another big question. Who is Job actually speaking to on this occasion? I think he's speaking in part to God. His friends are there listening. Maybe he's in some ways speaking to no one. He's just pouring out his heart. But God is there, and he's listening. And I think we need to ask that question. Is this the right way to speak to God? And I think my answer would be a similar sort of one. It's getting dangerous. And yet I think God would rather have us speak honestly than not at all. You see, God can already see our hearts. And I've told people, don't compound one issue with another. Don't compound your despair and your despondency with hypocrisy. You know what I mean? We show up at church, and you all look good this morning. You always look good. Even when you're going through intense struggle, we can usually pull it together for a brief time. I know some of you can't stay long. Some of you don't go into coffee time because you can pull it together, but not that long. And then we go out the doors, and sometimes we barely make it to the vehicle. Now, I'm not suggesting we come and just fall apart, but probably you should come and fall apart with someone. I'm not saying we come and just, there's everything over the coffee pot. It's like, let me just tell you all the struggles and brokenness in my heart. But maybe that should happen at least with someone. Again, we're going to have to come back to that a little bit, because Job will continue to speak in some pretty challenging ways. I would just add this part. Be careful in how casual you come around God. We know God is our Father. He's our Abba Father. I think there can become a version of that that says, because he is that and we have that great relationship with him, we can become flippant and casual and irreverent towards him. And I'm not sure that's what the point of that is. Like I said, we'll come back. The third big question it raises is, what do we do with the subject of death? It's all through here. Job never tries to take his life, but he certainly tells us his preference. And what do we do with that issue, but what do we do with his concept of death itself? That death is a preferable thing, because everyone just, it's the great leveler. Right? Because we know in the New Testament there's more to the story. And just, again, a preview of that. We're actually going to take a Sunday somewhere along the line and do like a theology of death in the afterlife. It'll be really exciting. We'll do it on Mother's Day. That'll be really good. I'm kidding. We won't. We will avoid that one like plague. There is such a thing that we would use the term progressive revelation to express, meaning that we learn more of God. There's more clarity as we work through the pages of Scripture. So in the Old Testament, you get glimpses of the redeeming work of God, but you don't have the full understanding. And then as you work through into the New Testament, you see Jesus, and it's like, oh, now I get it. Now it's clearer. That's a progressive revelation. The same thing will happen with death, with what's to come, with the afterlife. In the Old Testament, you get a word used, Sheol, and you get very limited description. You get about this much. Everyone goes, and you take nothing with you. In Job's mind, it's sort of the great leveler. Kings, nothing. Peasants, slaves, nothing. Now, that's not the end of the story. There's much more to it. And we need to honestly wrestle with this issue. In fact, if you've never wrestled with the issue of death and what's to come, I urge you to wrestle with it. Jonathan Edwards, when he talks about Job, here's what he says. I love this. We read it as though a strange thing that has happened but once in the world. So he's saying, when we read Job, we read it as a very strange story that happened one time. He goes on and says, perhaps we ought to read it as a normal thing that happens daily. For every man at death is deprived of everything as Job was. It's an interesting thought. He goes on and says, death is as rude with emperors as with beggars. It removes kings from the throne with as much ceremony as a peasant from his cottage. In other words, Edwards is saying, you better wrestle with this concept of death when you read through the story of Job, because in some ways, we will all have the same experience Job did sooner or later. We'll come back to that one again. Now, quickly, let's get to the five things. Where are they? Here we go. Buckle up. I'm going to talk fast. Number one is this. We learn some things about God and some things about Job. That's one. That's not two. We learn some things about God and some things about Job. And I'll just say it quickly because that's all it takes. We learn that the experience of depression does not mean that God is angry with us. Because nowhere in the book does God direct his anger at Job for what he says. Further, we learn about God that God is not, I'm going to use the word phased by this. It's not that chapter 4 is then God coming along and saying, oh, wow, I don't know what to do with Job. What do I do with a guy who's like, never happens? God will respond. There will be clear instruction from God. But God is not fazed by this, nor is he angry with Job over this. In fact, by the time we get to the end of the book, it's interesting, the only ones that God seems angry at are the three friends who come with such wonderful, theologically, almost correct things to say. And God gets to the end of the book and says to them, I'm going to rebuke you. And oh, by the way, you better go find Job and have him pray for you. Right? That's, in light of chapter 3, worth thinking about. What do we learn about Job? Well, we learn about Job what we all need to know, and that is that a believer can go there and back. You can go to chapter 3 and back. I'm so thankful that I've been open over the years about my own journey. So I get enough of depression to appreciate this. And to kind of know enough of how it feels to be able to kind of understand some of what I'm about to say next in number 2. Which is that in his darkness, it seems like Job can only look back with misery. He can't see the future. Which seems to be the one common element from experiences that I've known of, had, talked to people about. You can look back, but you are blinded to what's to come. And if you're there, or if you are the spouse of, the parent of, ministering to a friend who is in this spot, it is one of the hardest, most difficult things to help them work through. Because you can see the future and they can't. And you want to just take them and shake them. And I guarantee you the person who's in it knows there's something wrong too. They know, it's like, why can't I deal with this, right? And here's what it all boils down to. It boils down to this very, very simple issue. We need to convince ourselves that we do not depend on feeling, we depend on fact. Now, when you're in the middle of it, boy, sometimes that doesn't seem super helpful. What I've learned, personal experience speaking, maybe some of you will benefit from this. How do I put this? You need to know and convince yourself that what depression has done to you is inhibited your ability to think straight. It's almost like leprosy, in the sense that leprosy diminishes your ability to feel pain. You touch a stove, it's still hot. You just don't feel it. And when you're in depression, despair, your ability to feel things correctly has been diminished. Now, here's where that gets very difficult. We live in a society that has, by and large, rejected objective truth. Meaning, there really is something so foundational and true, it's unshakable, and it doesn't matter what you think of that thing, it's just true. We've gone, no. That's left us with only one thing, and that is subjective experience. How do you feel? How do I feel? Now, you mix that together with a person who is depressed and not feeling correctly, you start to understand the problem we're in. And you understand the solution, which is to constantly remember there are true facts. God still loves you. You just might not feel it. Which, interestingly enough, because your feelings are all messed up, your ability to feel correctly is diminished. Depend on the fact, not your feelings. I hope that comes across with grace, if you're there, as one who has been there and knows it. What you need, what all of us need, is at least one friend who has the grace and courage to come along and say, I'm just going to remind you. I want to remind you of the facts. I know you don't feel it right now. Can I just remind you of what's true? God still loves you. Job, God's still there. He hasn't given up on you. The story's not over. You might not see the future because it is so clouded and dark. But I can see it on your behalf. There is something on the other side of that cloud. All right. Going to run out of time. We're only on number two. Number three. This one's a curious one. Here's an observation that through this scene, Job does not complain about the circumstances he's just come through. He never mentions the loss of his home, his possessions, his children, or his health. The complaint is, I have no peace. I have no rest. And if you've been through this, you know exactly what he's talking about. The loss, the suffering becomes a side issue to the emotional pit of just ill at ease. There's no rest, no peace. Okay, so another. This might sound a little bit harsh for those of you who are outside the depression club. I'm so glad most of you are there. But you will probably minister sooner or later to someone who's in it. People who are in that need to know that they are not actually tired. It's just very, very practical. Right? Job is there 7 days. How much has he done? Has he worked a day's labor? No. He has done nothing. He sat on a mound of ashes and is complaining he has no rest. I would go, all you've done is rested, Job. And see, when you're in the middle of it and you can't get out of bed for like a day and you still feel exhausted, you need to remind yourself you're not actually exhausted. Your body is not actually exhausted. In fact, I'll take a cue. I'll just read Charles Spurgeon on this because he's more credible than me. A day's breathing of fresh air on the hills or a few hours rambles in the woods brings calm. A stiff walk in the wind's face gives grace to the soul and yields oxygen to the body. It's like, there's your cure. You find no rest, go for a walk. I'll leave it at that one. Number four, Job's suffering is not just an individual story. I take this from verse 20 on, where he moves from singular to plural. He essentially says, you know what, this is my story, but I'm not the only one. This is a much bigger issue. There are many living this. Now, at this point, for Job, that's just a problem. But isn't there something good about knowing that you are not the only one? Because some of you might be sitting here this morning going, no one knows. Like, I can't tell a person because no one's going to understand this. That is not true. Finally, there is hope in this story. Let me point it out to you, and then we're going to end. Chapter 3, verse 20. Why is light given? Stop right there for a second and think about what Job is affirming. There is a thing called light, and there is a giver. Now, at this point, it's the heart of Job's complaint. He doesn't like this, but he has not lost confidence that there is a God who gives and there is light that is given. That's a hopeful thing, even if it's in the form of a complaint. And you might be sitting here today and some of your complaint actually reveals your hope. The very fact Job is asking the question, why, to me is an incredible hopeful thing. You see, an atheist who's given up on God sitting on the ash pile doesn't ask questions. What would be the point? You just sit there in despondency. That's the end of the story. But a man who still has a little bit of faith and a little bit of hope asks questions. You see what I've learned of most people? Whether they start out Christians or not through depression, they end up pursuing God. Strange thing, because they end up with the question, why? And I would ask you, who are you asking the question to if it isn't God? Don't lose hope. Last part of that glimmer of hope is going to sound funny. Here it is. This is not as dark as the story gets. And by story, I mean this story. Because as we go through the pages and we meet a man who's going to be familiar with grief, who will take all of our sin upon himself, and then we come to read of him in the New Testament, the unique Son of God whose name is Jesus, we find out that the darkness that Job experienced is nothing in comparison to the darkness that Christ experienced. The forsakenness, the aloneness that Job experienced is nothing in comparison to what Christ experienced. The suffering that Job experienced was nothing in comparison to the suffering of Jesus Christ. And he did it all for you. That when we would turn from sin and trust in him, we could be forgiven and made right. And he said then, I'm going to hold on to you. I'm never going to leave you. I'm never going to forsake you. And so while your grip might be weak, his is always strong. And that to me is an incredibly hopeful thing.